In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
How are we to measure the impact of an immigration initiative? From SDPB, today is Wednesday, August 6th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the Dakota Political Junkies offer analysis on Operation Prairie Thunder. It's part public safety partnership and part political positioning. If that's a fair assessment, then how should the public measure the outcome? Are we to look at the crime statistics in Sioux Falls? Do we count removals and deportations? Or is the outcome best measured in election results? What, in other words, is the point of all of this? Tom Dempster and Jonathan Ellis are with us. But first, scholar and author Patrick Hicks joins us on the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima 80 years later. That conversation is coming up after the news. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Today is the 80th anniversary of the day the U.S. dropped the first atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. Patrick Hicks is a World War II scholar, Augustana University's writer-in-residence, and an author of several World War II novels. He stepped into our Sioux Falls studios for this conversation. You have been a scholar of World War II for how long now? How many books? And this has been a major focus of your academic work.
Yes. I guess formally I've been... well over 20, 30 years I've formally been studying World War II, but my interest in World War II goes back to childhood, really. Yeah. I was one of those kids that was building those model airplanes when I was, you know, 10 years old, and they were always model airplanes from the U.S. or Germany or Japan. So I've always had a fascination with what happened in the 1930s and 1940s.
Yeah. Why is it important? Because we're going to do a little history lesson, and then we'll talk about some of the impact, and then you'll read from your poetry anthology, Library of the Mind. But why is it important to go through the dates, the number of people killed, the reasons decisions were made 80 years later?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, aside from memorializing the event and remembering what happened, I think it's vital that we look back at history. And I think it's hard for us today to really think about how shocking the atomic bomb would have been to the world, because once it fell on Hiroshima, it was the first time anybody had heard of it, aside from those outside of the Manhattan Project who developed the bomb, of course. And even in the White House, President Truman hadn't heard of the atomic bomb until he became president in 1944. We're living in a world that has a before and after. The atomic age in the 1950s, obviously, was it was the beginning of the Cold War. And although we don't talk about the Cold War anymore, it's fair to assume that Russia and China have U.S. targets still to this day. And that is a sobering thought. And I think it's important for us to remember that. And also, not just at Hiroshima, but I'm thinking of the Cuban Missile Crisis and these moments that could have gone disastrously wrong for the entire world. So nuclear weapons, although we don't talk about them, are very much a part of our daily lives.
Yeah. And we're going to get in a little bit to the disastrous things that went disastrously wrong for the entire world from a humanity standpoint, from a moral standpoint with those bombings in the first place, some of those big questions that we're still asking ourselves. But let's go back for the people who are maybe younger, maybe need a new history lesson.
Yeah.
Where do you want to begin without giving the entire history of World War II? The decision to drop this bomb, what are some key factors of it?
Sure. And still to this day, it's controversial about whether the bomb should have been dropped at all. I mean, some people
we're
have
using
said,
a lot of passive tense, aren't we?
Yes. Yeah.
America.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. America. Yes.
We. Us.
We.
Yeah.
The leadership of America. And there's still controversy about whether the bomb should have been dropped by the United States or not. Maybe a demonstration could have been done to show the Japanese our capabilities. Maybe we could have blockaded them and starved them into some sort of submission. But the flip side to that coin is America was just exhausted from the war, and we had seen firsthand how fiercely the Japanese had fought in Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and many men, and I've met veterans, many men say that bomb saved my life. I'm pretty confident it saved my grandfather's life, because instead of being shipped off to fight in Japan, he stayed in California. The other thing we have with Hiroshima is that we can talk about the size of the bomb, and that kind of registers in our imagination. So the nuclear warheads that are around today are 10 times stronger than Hiroshima, and that gives us a scale. And I think that's important. Actually, before I came on your show, there's a website out there where you can actually drop a nuclear bomb in any American city just to see the blast radius. And the standard Russian and standard Chinese warheads today would completely obliterate the entire Twin Cities and all of its metropolitan area. So I'm positive that the Twin Cities are targeted. Sioux Falls would be targeted.
Ellsworth.
Ellsworth, for sure. Yeah. And even if they only drop the bomb on Ellsworth, I mean, all of the fallout would come East River, and people would be dying of radiation sickness.
Yeah. So this is catastrophic. How many people died on August 6th, 1945?
The numbers are hard to pin down. It's about 78,000 people were immediately killed in the blast radius itself. And, of course, they wouldn't have known what was happening because no one knew what an atomic bomb was. It was just a bright flash of white light and then the sound. And many people were vaporized, so you can actually – their shadows are all that remained. They were sort of incinerated, and their shadows are on steps and on walls and things like that. So it was about 78,000 just in the immediate blast. And then, of course, there'd be many more people dying from radiation sickness after that. And one of the things that I only found out very recently is that of those 78,000 people, about 20% of them were actually Korean, because Korea was a colony of Japan, and they had brought Koreans over as forced labor. And to this day, there are survivors from Hiroshima that are in a particular town in Korea.
Hmm. And it's followed by Nagasaki, another bomb very quickly.
Yeah. That fell 3 days later. So one of the things about the targeting, the United States was very tactical in its target of which Japanese cities they were going to go after. And Hiroshima, Kokura, Niigata, and Nagasaki were all four cities that we did not firebomb, precisely so that when the bomb was dropped on these cities, we could see from reconnaissance planes just how devastating the one bomb was. And I'm saying the number 78,000. But the people in charge of dropping bombs, both in Europe and in Japan, had gotten sort of used to these large numbers. We can think of Dresden, for example. Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse 5 is about that. Only a few months before the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, over the course of two nights, 100,000 people died in Tokyo. 100,000. So I think the thinking must have been, well, we're dropping all of these bombs and taking out civilians already, so what's the difference between one bomb and, say, thousands of bombs? That might have been the devil's calculus that was being done.
Hmm. You know, I just reread Slaughterhouse 5 this year, a couple months ago, and the numbers in that, because Vonnegut was pointing out how many people died in the firebombing of Dresden and how it's not reported, and it has an equivalent number, too. And I looked that up, and it's not true. Like, he was wrong about... He had gotten his numbers. It's a fiction. I mean, the book is fiction. But I guess when I was reading it, I always took those numbers as true, and now years later, apparently he got his numbers from... a source that has since been, you know, again, the numbers are complicated.
They are.
And in Slaughterhouse 5, those numbers of what happened in Dresden are higher. Not that that means anything from a humanitarian standpoint, but it doesn't mean something for when you read fiction.
Yeah.
That was published at a certain time. He would have gotten his information from somewhere. That information has now been updated.
Yeah.
My mind. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's hard. It's very hard for me to imagine almost 80,000 people just instantaneously being vaporized. It's a number that's just too big for me to kind of have in my head.
How impactful was the bombing from a humanitarian standpoint internationally? Like, do we have any sense of what the? I don't want to. Engage in presentism and say, well, now we'd be like, oh my goodness, I can't believe you did that. You know, they had different, it was so new.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm wondering is how did people begin to process the enormity of what had happened?
That's a great question. So Americans, like everyone else, would have woken up on August 6th to discover that we have this new wonder weapon. And then 72 hours later, another version is dropped on Nagasaki. And actually, we had two different types of atomic bombs. Little Boy, which was dropped from the Enola Gay on Hiroshima, and Fat Man, which was dropped on Nagasaki by a B-29 called Boxcar. So really within those 72 hours, and Japan surrendered very shortly after that, within those 72 hours, suddenly America was the superpower, because Russia didn't have a bomb yet. No one had a bomb like this. Overnight, we became the most powerful country on the planet, and World War II was not fought in the United States, so we were undamaged. I mean, this is one reason that...
Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, but good point. Yeah. And I suppose I could be technical and say, you know, Hawaii wasn't yet a state then, a territory, but you're absolutely
fair,
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Were we also the world's bad guy?
Oh, that's a thorny and complicated question, isn't it? Japan...
I mean, power is one thing. How you use it is another.
Yeah. I don't have an answer for that. I can see why. I mean, it's a crime against humanity, as far as I'm concerned, and yet it did end the war in 72 hours and undoubtedly saved not just American lives, but Japanese lives. I think that had bombs not been dropped, it's very likely that World War II would have dragged on until maybe 1947, maybe 1948. And who knows how many people would die as a result of that. And again, I call it the devil's arithmetic, because how do you balance the people that died in Hiroshima and Nagasaki against the potential loss of life of invading Japan?
Yeah.
The Japanese made it very clear that they were going to defend their homeland. Okinawa was one of the bloodiest engagements America had in the Pacific.
I think the International Red Cross calls it a failure of humanity.
Yeah.
In the sense that, not that the, you know, there should be a better alternative than war.
Yeah.
Blockade and starvation. Firebombing, nuclear, there should be, we can do better than that.
Yeah. This is, of course, one reason that we still keep talking about World War II, because it is a cautionary tale of, I mean, just think of how much technology has advanced in the last 80 years. An escalation between powerful countries could be global ending.
Yeah. What are some of the things that you think are overlooked in the conversation, you know, details? The mentioning the number of Korean people who were there, I thought is interesting. Other things in your research that when you first came upon them or when you teach them to students, people go, oh, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. Sometimes I'll go into the detail of the bombing itself. The Enola Gay, the B-29, which is this huge bomber, which could climb to such height that the Japanese really couldn't engage with it. And it was pressurized. It was the first bomber where it was comfortable inside. They didn't have to worry about the outside temperature of minus 35 degrees. And the Enola Gay, named after the Captain Paul Tibbetts' mother, carried little boy. And so it took off 6 hours. It took 6 hours to fly from Tinian Island to Hiroshima, 6 hours back. So the Enola Gay took off. Another B-29 called the Great Artiste took off, and that was designed to gather information about what the blast radius was and other things like that. And then there was a third B-29 that also took off called Necessary Evil, which was supposed to take photographs. The camera on Necessary Evil wasn't working, but one of the crewmen happened to bring a bomb, a camera along with him, and that's the only footage we actually have of Hiroshima today. Hardly anybody on the crew knew what they were dropping. The pilot knew, the bombardier knew, and that was pretty much it. So once Enola Gay was given the green light to bomb Hiroshima, because it could have gone to Nagasaki that day if the weather was inclement over Hiroshima, and it went on its bomb run, it dropped the bomb. It took about 45 seconds to fall, and as soon as the bomb left the bomb bay of Enola Gay, the plane was kind of thrown upwards because suddenly it was much lighter, and they immediately banked to get as far away from Hiroshima as possible. And the one that had the greatest view of that explosion, of course, would have been the tail gunner in the B-29. And he was given special goggles, and that his reports are really the only ones that we have, because he's the only one that could actually see it. The others, of course, were flying away from it.
Wow. In your travels, what sort of memorials and documentation and, you know, things have you come across as we seek to make sense of this?
Yeah. I haven't been to Japan, and if I ever do go, I'd want to go to Hiroshima. Because of course they have the Peace Garden there, and they've got objects that must be difficult to look at. I've had some friends of mine that have gone and, you know, melted Coke bottles, for example. They didn't have Coke, but you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. And some of the pavement slabs with the shadow of someone being vaporized. That's got to be very sobering. And of course, Japan doesn't have nuclear weapons today. And I think that's written, as I remember, I think that's written into their constitution that they can't have nuclear weapons.
But you have been to Europe, and you have been to numerous camps where millions of Jewish people lost their lives in the same conflict, although for two different theaters of operation. This is a really sobering and humbling and desperate time. It's just hard to talk. It's hard to get your mind around it.
Yeah,
you've been trying to get your mind around this for a long time. What have you gotten your mind around?
I'm not going to be very cheerful here, but I'm fully aware of what we were capable of doing to each other, and that is all the more reason why we should look back at history as because if it happened then, there's no reason it can't happen now. And I think to look back and see these as a cautionary tale is really important. Mm. And I did live in Germany for a while. I lived in a city called Kiel, which is and still is the naval port for the German the Navy. And Kiel got absolutely flattened by the British and the Americans. So when I was living in Kiel, it was kind of like it looked new because everything was new. Mm. And the flat that I was living in overlooked Kieler Fjorda. And just outside my window every morning, I'd have coffee. And maybe about 200 yards away was a ruined U-boat bunker. You know, the U-boats, the submarines, the pens that, and it was destroyed by the British or the Americans. I don't know which side destroyed it, but it's still there because it was built by Jewish slave labor. So every day I'm drinking my coffee, and there is a reminder. And I found out later that the sidewalk that I used all the time, they found a 500-pound American bomb underneath the sidewalk, and it was still active. And shortly after I moved, I found out that they discovered it a couple months later. So I was like every day walking over this, you know, literally a time bomb from the 20th century.
Yeah, wow. What else are we capable in the sense of moving on and going forth and doing better?
I don't have an answer for that. I look around at the world today, Ukraine, Gaza. There seems to be an indifference, especially in Americans, to sort of look away.
There's so much to look at.
Yeah, there is. There is so much to look at. We're not doing a very good job of really engaging, I think.
Looking at the right things.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've written about this in Library of the Mind. You've written about World War II and your engagement with this, you know, the academic aspect of this, but also with people that you've met.
Yeah.
I would love for you to read for us and set it up before you read with maybe what we're going to listen to.
Sure. Back when I was in college, which was a long time ago now, there was a guy in the town where the college was who had a barber chair attached to his kitchen, basically, and it was cheap, you know. So for 4 years, I'd get my hair cut every month, every other month, and slowly over 4 years, you can kind of learn. The stranger becomes a little less strange to you, and I discovered the last time I was there that he is actually one of the American soldiers that saw three atomic bombs drop in Nevada. Because in the 1950s, the United States was trying to figure out, well, we've got this weapon. How can we use it in a tactical way? So they would drop a bomb. This seems nuts to me today. They would drop the bomb, and then the soldiers would be in the trench. And after the bomb dropped, they were ordered to march towards the bomb just to see what would happen. It was just mind-blowing to me. But
what could happen?
Yeah, some general came up with that idea in the 50s. So. Yeah. So I asked him, what was it like to see an atomic bomb? And he's the only one I've ever met that's seen an atomic bomb. Thank God for that. So that's the basis of the poem. And it's about three pages. It's a prose poem, so it's going to read more like nonfiction, I think. But it's called Watching a Nuclear Explosion. Back in college, the man who cut my hair was a no-nonsense Minnesotan who had a barber chair in his house. Once a month, I knocked on his screen door and stepped into the smell of fresh coffee, the sound of WCCO radio murmuring from a shelf, and the manly musk of Pine Sol lifting off the linoleum floor. He said little. With a tidy swish, as if he were a bullfighter warming up, he draped a blue cloth over my body and cinched a priestly paper collar around my neck. Scissors swam in jars of blue disinfectant. It took 3 years of haircuts to learn that he had enlisted to fight the Nazis in late 1944, But just as they were ready to sail across the ocean, Europe was swallowed up by peace. 3 months later, he was steaming across the Pacific when a bomb the size of a Studebaker turned Hiroshima into a world of ash. It was a miniature sun that blasted open a new era. "Save my life, though," he said, snipping near my temple. A burnt matchstick world flickered in the movie house of my imagination. I saw blistered skin, shadows where people had once stood, and steel beams that had been melted into gloomy pools of gray. It took another season of haircuts to learn that he was later stationed in the high desert of Nevada. It was the early 1950s, and America was enthralled by the atom. The U.S. Army was trying to figure out how these wonder weapons could be used on a battlefield. Surely such fury could be tamed. Surely the elements could be managed. Someone with a mess of stars on his lapel decided to detonate a rising fireball and order his troops to march towards it. "I saw three explosions before I got out," my barber said, picking up a pair of oiled clippers. When he flicked them on, they sounded like static in my ear. "What was it like?" I wanted to ask. But before I could say the words, he retreated to the safer ground of sports, Vikings, North Stars, Twins. A slow fallout of hair landed in my lap. 2 weeks before graduation, I knocked on his door for the last time, and when I was propped in his chair, I stared ahead. "What's it like, seeing a nuclear explosion?" I asked. He snapped his scissors a few times and said nothing. After a long moment, his lips finally parted, and a chain reaction of words rushed into the room. They were in a trench a few miles from ground zero. It was hot and dry in the desert, like standing in an oven. Las Vegas was down the road, and he enjoyed whiskey sours with his friends the night before. Now they crouched against a dirt wall with their rifles, water canteens, and radios at the ready. After the explosion, a whistle would sound, like a trumpet on Judgment Day, and they would rise to march forward. They were given no earplugs or blast shields. Instead, they were told to make themselves small, to assume a fetal position in the trench, and to put their hands over their eyes. "Place the butt of your palm right over your eye socket," the CO had said at the morning briefing. "That hard, bony part above your wrist, that's what you want. Use both hands. Press them hard into your eyes. Do not look at the explosion until you're ordered to stand up. I repeat, do not look at the explosion." The man, who had become my barber, crouched in the trench and pressed his hands into his eyes. The numbers fell, one by one, before the bomb did. 5, 4, 3, 2. Light came first. It bathed him. It surrounded him. It was like being inside a light bulb, and he could see the bones inside his hand. It was dazzling and terrifying. A burst of thunderous wind tossed him against the other side of the trench. It was like being tackled or yanked sideways, but still he kept his hands screwed into his eyes, even as the wind continued to roar around him, even when his skin grew hot, even when he began to scream. And as heat and light raged around him, he focused on the bones in his hands, the pink of his blood, the bright sun licking at his face. After what seemed like a prelude to eternity, the wind slowed, stopped, and reversed itself. Now he was thrown back against the other side of the trench. Hot sand filled his nose. It pricked his cheeks like hot needles, and he breathed hard through his teeth. Sweat was sucked from his face, and still the dry hurricane raged around him, sounding like a jet engine full of squealing pigs. When the wind finally relaxed, when the light began to fade, and when he saw afterimages of his own bones, a whistle sounded. He was ordered to stand up and march towards what had just fallen. Wisps of sand skittered over his hands as he clambered out of the trench with his weapon. His knees were jelly, and he worried about tripping in front of his friends. A thunderstorm of noise rose before him, and when he finally mustered the courage to look at the towering fireball, his jaw fell. The mushroom cloud lifted into the stratosphere, pushing aside clouds, and it boiled in oranges, blacks, and yellows. As he walked toward ground zero, he saw purples and greens, hundreds of lightning bolts, too. It was nothing like he had seen in the training films. Every color the world had ever known, or would ever known, was rising in fire, burning away, vaporizing. It was a swirling cloud of destruction, a crackling thunderhead that kept swirling high into the atmosphere. It was an echo of the beginning of the universe itself. He placed one boot in front of the other, running now with his fellow soldiers, charging over burnt scrubland and arroyos, jumping over charred bits of cactus, and moving forward, forward, forward. His eyes taking in the rumbling core of the energy, the smash of atoms, the undone flash of an exploding star. The wind continued to suck up into the heavens, like the mouth of God taking in air. Its gray snow began to flutter down, clothing their helmets, their arms, their boots, and as they ran, the orange-pink cloud drifted upwards, crackling with thunder. The clippers stopped humming, and the man who was my barber unfastened the paper collar around my neck. He pulled the blue cloth off my body. "Congratulations, young man," he said after a pause. "This one's on the house. You take care." He died of cancer 5 years later, delayed wounds ticking in his cells like hidden detonations, snipping here, snipping there, cutting him down, quietly.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPV. I'm Lori Walsh. Last week, South Dakota Governor Larry Roden announced that the state will enhance crime and drug enforcement and support ICE. Operation Prairie Thunder is billed as a sweeping immigration enforcement initiative. It enlists South Dakota resources, state troopers, the Department of Corrections, and National Guardsmen to assist ICE. Our Dakota political junkies join me with their analysis in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. Jonathan Ellis is co-founder of the Dakota Scout, and Tom Dempster is a former South Dakota state senator. But before we get into immigration, Tom Dempster has a point he would like to bring up.
Excuse me, Lori, but before he answers that question, I have a bone to pick with Mr. Ellis.
Uh-oh, here we go.
I mean, I know he works 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, just like you, for sure. But he wrote a story, and in the story, he referred to reporters as a gaggle of reporters.
A gaggle?
Yeah, so I sent him a text message, and I said, it's not a gaggle of reporters. It's either a murder of reporters, like Murder of Crows, or a parliament of reporters, like Parliament of Owls. But it is not a gaggle of reporters.
Explain yourself. Why, if they can be crows and they can be owls, why can they not be geese?
That should be self-evident.
He retreats into the corner. Nice job,
Let's unpack the linguistic history of...
Well,
is it because of the nature of geese?
No, not at all.
No, okay.
A parliament, you presume, is wise. Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly think that reporters are wise,
and
right?
Crows.
A murder of crows. Mm-hmm. Reporters sometimes can be very dangerous. So be careful.
Gaggle
and watch
sounds
out.
Harmless.
So it's gaggle. Yeah, gaggle is just a bunch of cawing and squawking and cracking all that sort of stuff. I argue for sure parliament murder.
Now we have clarified this.
Okay.
Mr. Ellis, explain yourself.
He got his way out of the corner. Nice job, Tom.
Thank you.
Will you take this into account in the future? Do you think you perhaps need to rethink whether or not gaggle is the appropriate connotation you want to give?
Sometimes
readers?
We have to choose our words very carefully, but sometimes when you're in the heat of writing something on deadline, it's hard to do that. So I will in the future.
Yeah. You're never going to type it again without thinking.
True.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you regret writing gaggle of reporters?
I do not.
You're retracting or correcting?
No apologies whatsoever.
I mean,
there's no remorse whatsoever.
No. Come on. No, you can have lots of regrets in life, but I'm not going to over that
particular
waste word.
On that one.
Yeah.
I think well said, though. Think about word choice matters. Clarity of words matter. E.B. White is in the house, and
indeed,
he's letting us know that those distinctions matter. Speaking of words, I was reading the press release for Operation Prairie Thunder when it came out from Governor Roden's office, and I was wondering about some of the language, because I live in the city of Sioux Falls, and this is going to be piloted in Sioux Falls, and they were talking about National Guard helicopters being put into use, and I had to take a moment and think, do I know everything that's happening in Sioux Falls? Because that seems kind of a lot. I don't know that I feel like I live in an unsafe city. And the governor is saying this will have an immediate, significant impact on public safety. So my big question is, will Operation Prairie Thunder have an immediate, significant impact on public safety? How will we measure that? And what else is going on here? Because we're also in, a race for governor at some point. So, Jonathan Ellis, let's start with Operation Prairie Thunder and tell me what you saw in some of the communication from the governor's office and some of the questions that came to mind for you.
Well, I would say that this is one of those situations where a thing can be two things, right? And it's policy and it's also politics. Mm-hmm. And well, let's be very honest, the immigration issue was probably the number one issue number one or number two issues in the presidential election, because after 4 years of just extreme immigration across the southern border, a lot of voters got fed up with it. So from a political point of view, if you're somebody who might be thinking about running for governor, as in the current governor, it's probably good politics to look like you are contributing in some sense in that immigration issue. And these law enforcement agencies that have sort of rushed to get this 287G endorsement from Immigration and Customs Enforcement so that they can assist in at various levels in immigration enforcement, you've seen that happen. Hundreds and hundreds of agencies have flocked to do that since President Trump was reelected.
Now I'm listening to every word he says. Flocked.
Uh-oh,
rushed.
Here we go.
Did they rush to it? Yeah.
That's what you
did
get.
Did they rush to the 287G, or have they been part of this the whole time?
That's what you get. That's what you get when your business is having a pen in your hand.
There were. This program came about in the first Trump administration. Yeah. There were roughly about 140 law enforcement agencies across the country that had gotten that authorization. The Biden administration stopped it. No authorizations were given. And the Biden administration didn't go as far as what some immigration activists wanted, and just to terminate the contracts, period. But then as soon as Trump is reelected, so then you had, I mean, red states all over the place. So this is a political issue.
The dots started filling in on the map really quickly website for people who were signing agreements.
Yeah. Right. There were no agencies in South Dakota that had participated in the first administration. Now we have several, I think it is. Yeah. And it's so from a policy perspective, you can say that there are a lot of drugs that come through South Dakota, especially Sioux Falls. We intersect by two major interstates, 29 and 90, and if you talk to law enforcement, they will say, yeah, these are conduits for a lot of drugs. So does it help in that sense? Possibly. I'm not not in law enforcement, but I think some people in law enforcement would say that it might.
Yeah, which we'll circle back to, like, how do you measure the outcome here in a minute. Tom Dempster, Operation Prairie Thunder, what were some of the first things that you were looking at to evaluate this initiative?
I feel like I'm on the South Dakota State Senate floor, having to stand up and oppose a bill promoted by someone that I like and have a great deal of respect for. But I don't have any choice but to do so. When I hear the word Prairie Thunder, I think shock and awe. Prairie Thunder and shock and awe, I think, has mostly to do with essential workers that we now, that the governor's press release called criminal, illegal aliens. Just 4 years ago, we used to call them essential workers. Now they're criminal, illegal aliens. I think most of this had to do with ICE enforcement in South Dakota. I'm sure we'll have the opportunity to talk about that for sure. But one of the things that I know is I'm a former county commissioner, spent 9 years on the county commission and was head of the South Dakota County Commissioners Association. And one thing I know for sure, if there's any natural predator to government, it's any and every other entity of government. And what that means is that governments are always fighting for funding. Governments are always fighting each other for influence. And I'm going to expect, and Lori, I don't know this for sure because I haven't talked to the chief of police. I have not talked to the sheriff. I have not talked to the mayor. But I'm going to guess that the mayor, the chief of police, and the sheriff were there without enthusiasm. Law enforcement is a very prideful thing. It's very much of a fraternity. The last thing local officials, not to mention county commissioners or mayors, but the last thing that local officials want is a higher government, oh, by the way, that funds you, is a higher source of government saying, we think that you're ineffective, but saying that we can take responsibility for success in law enforcement in Sioux Falls. My guess, and I could be absolutely and totally wrong, My guess is that was met, is met without enthusiasm.
I have asked the Sioux Falls Police Department if they intend to pursue that 287G status, you know, one of those levels, and they've said no. Now that's several months ago. So I would agree with Tom, what he's saying, that they probably, they're not, there's not enthusiasm in Sioux Falls. But I would disagree a little bit, because a lot of law enforcement agencies do want that added, you know. And I would say also that a lot of law enforcement agencies participate in very, in federal drug interdiction programs, drug crimes against children programs on the internet. So, I mean, there are always varying degrees of local law enforcement participating with federal law enforcement.
Collaborations, yeah. I might say that any law enforcement leader goes to any press conference without enthusiasm.
Yeah.
It's not their best, you know, it's not their best days. Yeah, hey, we get to go do a press conference today.
I'm going
to
guess that's probably right.
You're probably safe on that, that bet. Sheriff Mike Milstead was on the show, you know, to your point, Jonathan, when you asked him, and, you know, he did not have any intention for his field deputies to be doing immigration work, and he explained very clearly what the role was within the jail of ICE holds, and that's always been happening, and it's really, really increased quite a bit with the new administration.
Yep.
How do you measure its success, Tom, then? How does Governor Larry Roden measure its success? How does he talk to the people of South Dakota, particularly Sioux Falls, about its success? Is it just an numbers? Because here's what I'm really wondering. Like, you can give me numbers of, like, how many arrests you've made. But then doesn't there have to be a public safety
result
impact?
Of that,
like,
for
if
sure.
You've told me I'm going to be safer, telling me you've arrested 150 people doesn't necessarily make me feel safer if the crime rate doesn't go down. So are these two things tied together?
Because
your point, essential workers are not necessarily, there are people who are here without status who have committed violent crimes. And there are people who are here because they've crossed the border illegally and or they've crossed the border without permission and they're removable. But that's not necessarily going to change the crime rate in Sioux Falls because they're not committing any crimes. Most of them are not committing any crimes. So how am I measuring success?
Well, that's a good question. If for example, to be clear, I think that the Prairie Thunder has been, they are targeting specific, they're targeting criminals. They're not targeting what Tom calls essential workers. They're targeting criminals. DCIs and Marty Jackley.
Do they say that, or they say they're targeting anybody who's here without status?
Marty Jackley has been very specific in saying that, for example, DCI agents are going to be used specifically for violent criminals.
Attorney General Jackley has said that.
And obviously, if you're using the Department of Corrections to identify people within the prison system, by definition, they've committed crimes.
They could be there for the, Sheriff Milstead said, you know, crossing without permission is a crime.
Not in prison.
But that could be in jail.
Okay,
but that could be their only crime.
We're talking about the Department of Corrections. So the Department of Corrections,
going back to
Governor Roden,
Yep.
We're talking very specifically about people. If you're incarcerated at the Department of Corrections, you by definition, you've done something very serious. Okay? I mean, most people, low-level offenders are not going to prison. Okay? So by definition, if you're using the Department of Corrections, you're using Highway Patrol, you're using for looking for those specific people.
So
I don't think
measuring success?
That's a good question.
Are deportations?
I mean, maybe that's the deportation numbers. I mean, what I want to know is, are they going to have a metric to measure success? Okay. Like, what would their metric be?
Yeah. What is the metric for measuring public safety?
Well,
isn't it crime?
When you're at a 5-year crime, I hope that Jonathan is correct. But when you're at a 5-year crime low, I don't know how you measure better public safety than what, be it a 6 or a 10-year crime low. But when you name something, Operation Prairie Thunder, Shock and Awe, and you've got a buffalo with sunglasses and lightning across the sunglasses, I'm going to think that this has more to do with an ICE conversation than it does with strictly law enforcement. And my fear is that all of a sudden South Dakota will become embroiled in what we've seen in other states, is essential workers now being charged with the misdemeanor of having inappropriately crossed a border and having so many of these people that are so essential to what America is be deported for that one misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. That's what Prairie Thunder says to me. Shock and awe, helicopters, airplanes, shock and awe. That's what it says to me. I hope Jonathan is right. I hope I'm absolutely wrong.
Let's talk a little bit about another news story here, which is the Secretary of State and this information that was put into the world because of a law that took effect on July 1st, and it turned out to have information that you can't put into the world. Jonathan, explain to us what happened here.
Yeah, so the Secretary of State's office was required to publish a list of the registered voter list. That list has always been publicly available. It's just that you've had to pay for it.
A
lot of money, yeah. If you wanted the statewide list.
Who bought it before?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah,
Clinical
came in. Did you buy it? No, you would have bought it like a legislative district. I mean, you could buy various, so you don't have
to. Oh, okay.
You can buy pieces. You can buy it, by district. I think you can even precinct level.
And I've got a walking list as a result of that, so okay. I know when I'm knocking on somebody's door, whether they're Republican
or Democrat,
whether they're going to yell at you or not, or whether they voted.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So you have voting histories.
Which is why when people knock on my door, they always look at me like, I don't really know who you voted for because I'm an independent.
Right. No.
Yeah. Oh, there's but secret ways of finding
and they're not going to vote on. You're not going to get primary candidates running because you can't vote in the primary, right? So,
come to my door anyway.
It's valuable. Well, it's valuable information. It's been valuable for political campaigns and. The legislature wanted the information more readily available out there as sort of a voter integrity thing. They think that if it's the more transparency, and I don't disagree with that, the more transparency, the better. Unfortunately, the Secretary of State's office.
This is a case where the more transparency wasn't better.
Yeah, this was a case where, so they publish it. Now, so when you're registering to vote, there are a multitude of places you can register to vote, and one of them is if you're applying for a public assistance program. And the Secretary of State's office, this was not public, but this was part of where you apply or where you registered to vote. And it obviously gave away people who were registering for SNAP or WIC or other social services programs because it had their source of where they'd registered. So we knew about 7,700 people were on this list who had been identified as having registered to vote while seeking public assistance. And that's a violation of federal law, multitude of federal laws, and state laws protect the privacy of people who are on these programs. Mm. So obviously that was a big, the Secretary of State, and this is the legislature and the Secretary of State kind of have a conflict in a way because the exceptions to what was supposed to be published were spelled out in state law, but it didn't include that. Didn't include the source of where you registered. So, at some point, the Secretary of State's office is kind of stuck between, maybe we have to do this because, I don't know what was going through their head. They're not very, very transparent. Although I will say the Secretary of State last week, apologized and took responsibility for it, and they took the information down because, regardless of what the legislature's intent was, I'm sure the legislature didn't intend that. They just didn't have the have it spelled out in the rules. They would have been preempted by federal law anyway.
Tom, when you saw this unfold, what were some of your thoughts? Was there a lack of communication, a lack of awareness that that was something that needed to be exempted? Nobody had thought that through when they passed the law? From a state legislature standpoint, what went wrong?
I don't know. My guess it was improper due diligence. Whoops, I made a mistake. I shouldn't have.
By the state legislature or by the Secretary of State?
By the Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. Whoops, I made a mistake. I'm going to have to suffer the consequences. I'm sure there will be lawsuits. But the first thing I'm going to do is apologize. And she did that.
Yeah. What happens next? There will be lawsuits.
Potentially, yeah. I mean, people who are I've had inquiries from people who want the list. I mean, obviously, it was taken down. We have a copy of the original. Mm-hmm. It's been asked that everybody who had one to destroy it. I don't think we're going to do that, but we've had requests from those in the legal community who are very interested in getting that list, presumably to solicit names that were on the list who were exposed as potential on social services programs.
So a group of reporters is a murder of reporters, isn't it?
Well,
and let's hope they're a parliament of owls.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, you know, you receive information, whether it's improperly received or whatever. It's not we didn't do anything wrong, so you know it's there. And I think it's there are potential.
What are the ethics of keeping it?
I've received information that I wasn't supposed to get many times in my career, and
who was that? Daniel Berrigan?
You're not publishing it.
No, we have not. No, of course not. We wouldn't do that.
That should be clear for listeners who are.
We have not published it.
Yeah. You're not putting it out there.
No.
Yeah.
Who was that? Daniel Berrigan, the Pentagon Papers?
Right. I mean, this is.
Sure.
So.
It's a murder of crows.
The idea of when you register to vote, though, and I just can't wait to ask you this question now that it started coming out of my mouth, because I know what you're going to say. You know, you register to vote and your address is on there. For many people, whether it be a public figure, a state legislator, a victim of domestic violence, you know, somebody who doesn't want their address, a single female, who doesn't want their address to be out there, a single male, who doesn't, I mean, anybody, lots of people don't want their address to be published, but they also want to vote. Is there a chilling effect to having your address published? Because you registered to vote, will some people say, well, I'm not going to register to vote then?
Oh, Lori, I think that there are probably 20 or 30 different ways for me to find out your address. I think I can go to White Pages and pay a fee, or go to Yellow Pages and pay a fee. And not only can I find your address, but I can find your criminal history, and I can find out all sorts of things about you. I'm not so certain that the publication of voters list, including your address, and I think your phone number.
I'm quite confident. There were phone numbers and some emails too.
Yeah, and emails. I'm not so. I mean, I can find out anything and everything about you anyway. I'm not so certain that this damages
that. That gives me comfort, though.
It shouldn't.
You know, and there are people who are trying, you know, to eliminate that and are taking steps to be off, you know, the easy access.
Yeah.
For especially domestic violence is what comes to mind.
Well, they've made it more difficult. I mean, when I say the legislature, and again, in terms of trying to what they would perceive as flaws within the voting system, have tried to like eliminate, you know, P.O. boxes or the mailbox companies that you could register to vote through, things like that, RV parks, things. Mm-hmm. So they have increased the transparency. To your point, Lori, I mean, yeah, I mean, because there might be some people uneasy about that. But to Tom's point, it's very easy to find. You can use for even modest amounts of money very powerful search engines that can find anyone anywhere. I mean, that's just a reality.
And secondly, if you're going to vote in a legislative district, you have to live in that legislative district. You have to have an address. And ultimately, a voter is going to have to come to the recognition that, okay, maybe I might a lot, or maybe I might modestly increase my threat of somebody finding out who I am and where I live. And I'm going to guess you probably have to make the conscious decision of saying, increased threat, maybe a little bit, but it's worth it for me to vote.
That's Jonathan Ellis, co-founder of the Dakota Scout, and Tom Dempster, former South Dakota State Senator. You can find this conversation and our other political analysis on your podcast feed. Search SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies for extended conversations. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngerman. I'm Lori Walsh. From all of us at SDPB, thank you for listening.